Wherever you're listening, if you are in Australia, you're on Aboriginal land. At the National Film and Sound Archive of Australia, we pay respects to the elders and acknowledge their ongoing custodianship of the country where we made this podcast and of the country you're listening to it on. By the mid-1930s, Australia was changing fast. The country emerged from the hardships of the Great Depression, when employment was over 30%, with their spirits buoyed by a true blue cricket legend.
Who is it that all Australia raves about? Who has won our very highest praise? Now is it Amy Johnson or little Mickey Mouse? No, it's just a country lad who's bringing down the house, and he's our Don Bradman.
And a homegrown engineering triumph.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, here we are, right on the job as usual. This is John Harper announcing the Paramount Sound News. This is Saturday, the 19th of March, 1932. The official opening of the Sydney Harbour Bridge, made in Australia by Australians for Australia.
And then there was radio. This amazing technology brought the world into your living room, and Australians couldn't get enough. By 1937, just 15 years after that first official broadcast, the radio had pride of place in two out of every three homes. The family would gather around to listen to the news and the races, to the soaps and the serials, to riveting dramas and side-splitting comics. Now it wasn't just about heading home for your dinner. You also wanted to catch your favourite show. Just as Henry Ford's assembly lines created the relentless rhythm of the workday, radio reshaped your downtime.
People loved their radio serials, and they'd have a radio serial at 9 o'clock in the morning, 11 o'clock in the morning, another one in the afternoon, and a few at night, and all of that.
Radio created formats that live on today.
Television pulls a lot of the formats that we get out of radio: quiz shows, newscasts, dramas, soap operas, get pulled from this radio serial tradition that's growing globally.
And it created new stars, many of whom would make the move to television. The golden years of radio may have only lasted a few decades, but they helped shape the media of the 21st century. I'm Patrick McIntyre, and you've tuned into Who Listens to the Radio, brought to you by the National Film and Sound Archive of Australia. This is Episode 2, Golden Years, in which we look at radio's glory days. Radio soon became an essential part of daily life. It was great at bringing you the news, especially if you lived in the country, where it might take 4 days for the newspapers to arrive. During World War II, newsprint was severely rationed, so if you wanted to hear the latest news from the front, you switched on your set. But while radio was good at news, it was even better at entertainment, creating the first generation of couch potatoes. Why get dressed up to go to the theatre when you could stay at home with a cup of tea and switch on your set?
So the first American radio play was The Wolf by Eugene Walter in 1922. It's a log cabin drama. And then the BBC's Twelfth Night was the first British dramatic play to air in 1923. In Australia, it was 1925's The Barbarous Barber. So horror radio is embedded into Australian radio media and radio drama from the very beginning. My name is Jo Palazuelos-Krakowski. I am a Fulbright scholar and PhD candidate at UC Santa Barbara in theater studies. What's really cool about radio serials is, well, you think about it, you have to fill content, right? You've got all of this airspace. And the radio serial is fantastic because it allows you to revisit the same characters. So you don't have to do all that groundwork, but you put them in new situations and you can tell longer stories over a longer period of time.
Those stories included comedy, crime, the supernatural, and even a homegrown Superman series. At first, they were based on American and British formats, but later, local shows like Blue Hills and The Naked Vicar Show became hits.
Time everybody got away. I'm not sure that we shouldn't be taking Topsy into Wagga ourselves, Rose.
But it'd be silly two cars going, Uncle Ed. And Uncle Jim said ages ago.
Radio was a communal experience. Every time you tuned into your favourite show, you knew countless other people were listening at the same time, and next day you'd all be talking about it at work. And that was part of the thrill. Like the internet in a later age, radio connected you no matter where you lived. Radio took inspiration and sometimes performers from vaudeville theatre, a mashup of songs, dance, magic and comedy. Vaudeville performers were also great at ad-libbing, which was important for radio, as industry veteran Bruce Ferrier explains.
That ability to ad-lib also carried over into radio serials and the radio serial actors, because the cost of a disc, because I used to cut the acetate for a recording live, and you had these machines that would carve out the grooves of the master disc. They cost about £2 each. Sounds like nothing today, but it was a huge amount of money. And so radio actors quickly learnt in Australia that if they made a fluff and screwed up a disc, they were less likely to be employed for the next serial. Resultantly, they too were able to ad-lib, and it was something for which Australian radio actors were internationally renowned.
Australian radio actors were the best sight actors in the world. So you could put a script in front of them, and they would just murder it in the best way possible.
Among the biggest names to move from the theatre to the radio was Roy Rean, better known as the iconic character Mo. His live segment on the Calling the Stars program was hugely popular, and beloved performers like Ruth Cracknell, for many decades one of our biggest stars, you may remember her from Mother and Son, she also got her start in radio. Here's a clip of Ruth talking about her very first job in a radio drama.
We'd get dressed up in evening dress and we'd be very glamorous, and we'd all be lined up on chairs, and there'd be a microphone in the centre of the stage, and there was often a piano over there, and there was a sound effects box with gravel and coconut halves for the horse's hooves, and a door which would open and shut, and I always wanted to do sound effects, really.
He's got a gun too!
One of the most successful radio drama companies in the world was Australian. But it was founded by Texan Grace Gibson. She first visited Australia as a sales rep for the Radio Transcription Company of America. That was a company that sold recordings of dramas to be adapted for new markets. Bruce Ferrier is now the owner of Grace Gibson Productions.
And still had, right to the very end, a really broad American deep south accent, that sort of thing. But she was a remarkably good sales lady. The managing director of 2GB, Alan Bennett, went over to Hollywood in the very early 1930s to do a bit of a study on what the new innovations in radio were. And he quickly realized the big up-and-coming thing was radio serials. So he met up with a group called Radio Transcription Agencies, and with them there was this lady selling transcriptions. Her name was Grace Gibson. She sold him every single serial script that they had, but he did it on the basis that she had to be seconded to come to Australia for 6 months to show them how to set up a recording studio and run it and all of that sort of stuff. So she was there from 1934 when she arrived out in Australia. She was on a phenomenal £40 a week, about $80 a week. The average male worker, and bear in mind it was a very male-dominated industry, would have been on probably a fiver a week. She was on eight times that. So she was doing very well right from the very beginning.
Here's NFSA curator Torsten Kading, who we met in episode one.
She founded what became the biggest radio series production company in Australia, and they produced hundreds and hundreds of different titles all through that period. Yeah, I think it's a lovely, fantastic piece of history that Grace Gibson as a woman was able to do that, but also highlights the fact that particularly in that period, women were really at the center of radio in a way that I think we've forgotten. So it's fantastic to bring those stories out. And yeah, Grace Gibson obviously is a prime example of that.
Her main trick was to buy American radio transcription scripts and then bring them back here and get them localized, Australianized. So you had shows like Dragnet, Nightbeat, and so on. And indeed, even Portia Faces Life, which was a daily soapy.
Kingston and Civic Centre present today's instalment of
Portia Faces Life, a story taken from the heart of every woman who has ever loved completely.
Now, these were daily soaps that would be on air Monday to Thursday in the mornings, and they'd be just ongoing storylines, a bit, I suppose, like Neighbours or Home and Away, where the story just keeps on folding from one adventure to another to another to another. There's no beginning and no end to it, but it just keeps on going.
Before long, Gibson switched to using Australian writers, and many of them women.
So in terms of radio series, there were a lot of series written by women. A lot of the biggest radio series were written by women, like Blue Hills. And also, because they are dramas in the same way we'd produce dramas now, with actors playing those roles, a lot of female actors became really, really famous in Australia during that radio period. The announcers were almost entirely men. But a lot of what was going on in terms of writing and production, women were heavily involved, which, yeah, I think is a story that's worth telling.
From the beginning, women were an important audience for radio, and their tastes were surprisingly varied. Here's Jo.
Well, I think that women's place in, like, horror radio, both performance and horror radio audiences is really interesting because they were a huge part of the demographics that these shows appealed to. Broadcasters found that very quickly. So if you look at the show The Witch's Tale, which airs in America in 1931 for the first time, and that's where kind of the radio horror serial is thought to begin.
A 122-year-old I be today. Yes, sir, 122-year-old. Well, Satan, if you'll tell everyone to douse their lights, we'll spin a little yarn about a pretty night of evil. The night of Halloween.
The Witch's Tale, which is hosted by a female narrator. And so they knew that women were just tuning in to these all the time. So in Australia, when it airs in Sydney on 2UZ in 1942. And it's aired two times during the week, on Thursdays at 7:30 p.m. But it's aired at 11 a.m. on Tuesdays. And who's listening? Women, right? Because that's what the programming slots, right? Kids are off to school. And especially radio early days, it wasn't something that was very transportable. Women were listening and they knew that. So women were making up huge amounts of the audience. But yeah, it also gave a lot of really great opportunities for female performers like Neva Carglin or Lyndall Barber, who stars in The Witch's Tale.
Many shows were recorded live, and those recordings would then make their way around the country.
You'd have a rehearsal, so everybody in the studio, right, rehearse, bang, and then, okay, now let's go for the record. And so they'd hit the record button and then record that episode. From there, that acetate would go off to a production pressing company, and about six copies maybe of that serial were made, and then they were sent out eventually to radio stations across Australia. So you might start off with, say, one disc going to maybe a Brisbane radio station. From there, they would post it on to maybe the Ipswich station. They might then post it on to the Toowoomba one, and then they would post it on to Roma, and then on to Charleville, etc., etc. And so one disc could cover a huge area.
Like any new technology, radio changed life in unexpected ways. It helped bring families together. Most households only had one radio, so the programming had to appeal across the generations.
So they were the absolute golden days of radio, and that's the era of Jack Davey, John with the Quiz Kids, all of those sort of shows. And you had the Caltex Theatre, the Nile Radio Players, etc., etc. All of these shows for both daytime, but very especially nighttime.
But it also caused new types of conflict, and not just fights over what to listen to. Famous writer Miles Franklin complained about her neighbour's radio keeping her awake at night, a new phenomenon for city dwellers. Radio was seen as an essential part of modern life. For many working-class households, the radio was often their first, and only, electric appliance they purchased. The Australian Council of Trade Unions declared that every home, no matter how poor they may be, is entitled to a radio in the house. But it wasn't cheap to get one of those big radios with their complex vacuum tube technology.
This is Andy True, your science correspondent. Yes, vacuum cleaners. I mean vacuum tubes. Ever wondered about those, you know, vintage-looking tubes in electronics? Meet vacuum tubes. They control electric currents in a high vacuum, making them the OGs of electronic devices. From thermionic tubes for signal amplification to vacuum phototubes detecting light, you know, they've had quite the journey. Picture hot tubes in audio amps emitting a cool red-orange glow. Iconic, right? Take the diode, aka Fleming valve, invented in 1904. It's the simplest tube with electrons flowing one way, cathode to anode. Add control grids and voila! They become the heart of early electronics, powering everything from radios to TVs. Fast forward to the 1940s. Semiconductors took over. Smaller, cooler, and more efficient. Transistors edged out tubes in the 60s, but the cathode ray tube held strong in TVs until the 21st century. Believe it or not, these tubes still persist in microwaves, high-end audio amps, and electric guitars for that, you know, classic warmer sound. Just remember, not all electronic valves are vacuum tubes. Some are gas-filled wonders, exploring electric discharging gases without the heater drama. Back to you, Patrick.
Nothing could slow the radio boom. In the 1930s, the Postmaster General commissioned an average of 9 new commercial stations each year. Religious groups and trade unions snapped up stations of their own. With so many new licenses, hundreds of stations had their wavelengths recalibrated to avoid interference. And back then, there were already debates about media ownership. Keith Murdoch's Herald and Weekly Times was described as an octopus in the air because it held licenses in multiple states. A radio license cost just £25, but you could rake in big advertising dollars, making radio just as much of a threat to newspapers as the internet is today. Advertisers helped shape radio programming. In fact, the term soap opera was a reference to the soap manufacturers who sponsored serials in the US. The biggest advertisers didn't just sponsor shows, they even produced them. Australian shows, like the Lux Radio Theatre, which was recorded live in the studio, were glamorous events, with performers as well as the audience dressing up for the occasion. And then there was Australia's Amateur Hour, the precursor to The X Factor and The Voice. Starting in 1940, it ran for 19 years and featured amateur performers from every corner of the country. And it helped reflect the changing social and cultural face of Australia in the 20th century. Here's a clip from a 1952 episode featuring vaudeville and country legend Chad Morgan.
Well, now for aircraftsman Chad Morgan, who's a hillbilly. He's our seventh artist tonight. What's that Chad stand for?
Cut that out, Mr. D. Can't leave that out.
Well, I don't know. Is it rude? What's it mean?
No, just Chadwick.
Oh, Chadwick, is it? That's a pretty fussy sort of name for hillbilly, isn't it? How do you come by that,
Chad? I don't know. My parents just picked it up.
Did they? Yeah. As far as
at this time, broad Aussie accents weren't often heard on the radio, unless you tuned in to Dad and Dave.
Dad and Dave from Snake Gully, which I think starts in the 1930s and had a series of movies made as well coming out of the radio show. It was that popular. It's hugely popular and launched the career of a lot of people in radio.
What are you doing, Dan?
I'm very busy. 2 and 5 is... why don't you do something useful instead of sitting with your nose in the paper all night?
Oh, I've finished the paper now.
Don't talk.
Dad and Dave was one of those where, because it's comedy, they were able to use really broad Australian accents that you didn't hear anywhere else on the radio or anywhere else for that matter in a media sense. So I think that was part of what made it hugely popular and was able to connect to people.
Radio announcers were expected to use received pronunciation, also called BBC English.
Lifebuoy present the 498th programme of Australia's Amateur Hour, a full hour with the amateurs of Australia relayed over a nationwide network of 48 stations, and to our armed forces in the Pacific and Japan over Radio Australia.
There's no doubt at all that speaking proper Australian was really very... It was a very much of an Australian version of British. And, I mean, just listen to the politicians of the day, like Sir Robert Menzies, you know, a very rounded sort of cultured, but it was a cultured Australian accent rather than a very British one, but it certainly had big heaps of British overtones in there. Likewise, newsreaders and announcers, especially on the ABC, but also in commercial radio, very much. That was the scene standard to be. And it was an era. And in fact, even when I joined in radio, it was still an era of if you had a really good voice, then you were halfway there sort of thing. That only started fading away, I suppose, in the 1970s onwards when it became a lot broader and a lot more relaxed and Aussie-fied, I suppose.
This is Wendy Harmer, comedian, author, and legendary radio presenter. We'll be hearing more from her in episode 4.
It is quite amazing when you think about it, how the Australian accent has changed on the radio. You know, how in the early days you'd have to be speaking in a rather cut-class accent, like the Queen. Margaret Throsby talks about how when she started on the radio, she'd have to speak very nicely and, you know, be very particular. And of course now, you know, you've got people like me whose voice was once described as the brakes on a tram. So we do hear that embrace of the Australian way of speaking. And I don't think we listen to radio anymore and we think, gosh, that's a really broad Australian accent. We don't sort of arc up about that, but we used to, of course. And I guess the challenge coming along is to see how we embrace other accents on radio. I don't think we're quite there yet with how we deal with that in the way that we listen.
An even bigger change was on the horizon. Television was coming, and history was about to repeat itself. Television would steal its ideas and stars from the radio, just as radio had done to theatre.
Whatever you think of when you think of television content like that, started on radio, those genres. So a successful case study in terms of a show would be Homicide, started on radio. Some of the radio actors went on to have huge television careers. Bud Tingwall's an example. We started on radio and was a big star on radio before television started. Lots didn't transition, I think, similarly to film.
But video didn't necessarily kill the radio star. Many survived and made the switch to the small screen. And despite some grim predictions, the arrival of television in 1956 didn't kill the radio industry either. Instead, radio reinvented itself, and not for the last time.
There's no doubt that television had a big impact on the radio serial. And I think primarily the sort of impact it did was it closed down a lot of those soapies we were talking of earlier, you know, the Portia Faces Life. For them to continue, they realised that they needed to have shorter storylines, self-contained storylines of maybe 104 episodes. That would run for about 5 or 6 months. But it would start with Portia becoming involved in a case, Portia following that case through and getting a conclusion to it, and then that would finish, and then she'd go into another adventure. And that's how the last few years of Portia Face's life happened, and why it continued through into the 1970s by adapting into being a serial as against a radio soapy.
There were other changes too. With 3-minute pop songs now filling the airwaves, radio developed a new rhythm.
So as television is kind of supplanting radio as a medium, and transistor radios are coming in and people are listening to radio in their cars or on the beach, there's less of that people sitting down and listening to a half-hour radio drama. So what happens? People are listening to Top 40, they're listening to music. And so what these radio writers did for this particular series, which is so interesting, is they put together this series, they took horror radio and they took that kind of shortened time slot, and they would write these little 3-minute ghost stories that were just such a blast.
Anything longer than that they saw as being too long. And so resultantly, Gibson started producing these short little 3-minute episodes of things like Harvest of Hate, My Father's House, Without Shame, and so on. But the problem was, to recap the beginning of every day, you'd used half a minute there, and to build up to some sort of climax, you only had a couple of minutes in which to do that. So it all became just a little bit too claustrophobic.
The decline of the serial marks the end of radio's golden age.
I always like to think that our radio serials are the perfection of the podcast, to be honest. And maybe that's a little bit egotistical, but the thing I love about our radio serials is that you've got sound effects, you've got atmos, you've got actors who really know what they're doing and how they're living that story, living that character, living that role. And you get all of that with the embellishment of sound effects. The golden years of radio really were fairly short if we look back at it. It would have been from around about the late 1930s, but probably even more so post-war, post-Second World War, probably 1940s when families started coming back from overseas service and all of that sort of thing. And from there through for the next 20-odd years, they were the absolute golden years of radio. Radio certainly did change, has changed, and will continue to evolve. I mean, we're watching it now as slowly but surely broadcast radio starts disappearing altogether. In fact, talking to a couple of technical engineers in the radio industry, they're saying that networks are now saying this will be the last transmitter we'll be buying because it'll all be going online, etc., within the next decade to 15 years. And a transmitter's going to last about that long, maybe a little bit longer. But they really were aware that broadcast radio as such will change, but it's just moving into more use of an audio medium. And that will develop and open up things, as we've seen with podcasts coming in, and they're having their big impact.
We'll be taking a closer look at podcasts in episode 6. But before then, there are some big changes about to shake up radio. When a new technology, the transistor, appears, radio morphs once again. Instead of being something you went home for, it became something you take with you.
The transistor radio meant that you could take it into your bedroom, the bathroom, you could take it to parties, you could take it to the beach, you could take it anywhere, it was in your car. Instantly, music was accessible everywhere.
In the next episode, we look at how the transistor radio helped power a cultural revolution by paving the way for a new phenomenon, the teenager. This has been Who Listens to the Radio, brought to you by the National Film and Sound Archive. Thanks to our guests, Bruce Ferrier, Joe Palazuelos-Krukowski, Wendy Harmer, our science communicator Andy True, and of course, NFSA curator Torsten Kading. You can visit our Radio 100 digital exhibition at nfsa.gov.au. If you've enjoyed Who Listens to the Radio, don't forget to rate or review wherever you get your podcasts.